So, but just let me just quickly, because our time is going to run, to just lay out a few other things. This dependence, though, that we have in many different ways, right, however you want to define your dependence, is intimately connected to an endless growth economy. And there isn't a single political party that I've heard of in Canada that would say, I'm going to strive to move to a steady state economy. But endless growth, like to speak against growth, on a limited planet, endless growth is not possible. And all of you know, in the human body, the cancer cell is the only one that keeps on dividing and doesn't die as it, when it should be, right? You know, supposedly the mature differentiate, mature, and then decay and die. That's the normal natural cycle. And that doesn't occur, it destroys the host that's carrying it. And so we cannot have an endless growth economy on a finite planet. That's why China is a perfect example. They're just late in getting in the game, and they're trying to do, you know, very rapidly what we have done, you know, from the 18th century onward. And you can understand it. It's raised, you know, over 20 million people out of poverty in a very short time, you know, whatever. So on the one hand, impressive. On the other hand, totally not sustainable. Right? So that's the other thing that we are dependent on, and not just in political discourse, we all buy into sort of the kind of growth economy. Quickly, the third thing with that comes basically a consumer culture. After the Second World War, which was one way of finally putting an end to the Depression, the Great Depression, is everybody was employed, you know, women got jobs, you know, because the factories needed women, etc., etc. Now what do we do? The war's over. And that's really where Madison Avenue kicks in, and we have to then convert people into consumers. Before the Second World War, people weren't defined, nor was their culture defined as consumers. So how do you keep on getting people to consume? And of course, people discovered then in the mid-70s, you know, the American dream isn't working as well. We need at least two people to work per household to keep up with the American dream. And when that wasn't enough, that's when really the credit card was introduced. And so our domestic debt in Canada and the U.S. is higher, I think, than our respective national debts. So in other words, it's actually unsustainable in many, many ways. Consumer culture, though, is necessary if we're going to have endless growth. Like, where are you going to sell yourself? And obviously, fat obsolescence has to be a part of it. Otherwise, you know, if you actually build, like when my parents married, and my grandmother writes beautiful letters of everything they got for their wedding, but it was the furniture from their grandparents that was the furniture that they then put into, you know, okay, they had this dining room set, etc. Because it was solidly made. It's worth passing on. It's, you know, it's real wood. And so rather than, you know, the stuff that collapses very quickly and has to be done over and over. So good craftsmanship is valued. You know, making things well is being valued, you know, and in the consumer culture, actually not, because the main thing is everything gets commodified, everything gets sold, you know, etc. And undergirding that, and again, it's another thing we didn't invent. You know, if you want, we come by it honestly, but from the 18th century to now, gradually, the belief in progress has become actually, regardless of whether you consider yourself religious or non-religious, you know, and maybe, hopefully, people who have, you know, strong spiritual foundations should be able to go against it. But that has become the faith of the modern age. You know, and so whether you're Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist, it's amazing how many people have bought into progress as ultimately, okay, we have to keep on moving forward. And it's very hard to argue against progress. What are you? Against progress, you know, or whatever. Or that's the sweet smell of progress, you know, when you hear the pulpits. Smell the pulp mills or whatever. Or that's the price we have to pay for progress. But why is progress the absolute? So if we want to work on hope, we have to learn to love what is actually absolute. Land is priceless. You can't really put the land. I mean, there are people who are trying. It's a desperate attempt. But I mean, it's a worthy attempt. There are economists who are now trying to say, okay, how many trillion dollars worth do bees actually supply us with? And not just commercial bees, but, you know, all the pollinators. If every third bite you take or something, you know, is dependent on a pollinator. But in a certain sense, it's priceless. Right? Healthy topsoil. We are all dependent on healthy topsoil. That is a priceless thing. Right? So rather than progress, we have to progress. No. We have to learn to value what is ultimately valuable. right? And that's a major shift. And of course, the quote that you know, the phrase that Carmel said comes from Ian Forster. It's Howard's End, and there's two important phrases. The one is only connect, and we are very good at not connecting. You know, so a lot of you will have heard about The Last Child in the Woods, Richard Love, you know, whatever, who came up with the phrase the nature deficit disorder, right? So only connect kids back to. And connect ourselves, you know, not just kids, connect ourselves back to nature, because nature has an amazing healing powers. Its very complexity can cure our mind in a certain sense from our simplistic ways of thinking, right? But the other phrase out of that same book, Howard's End, is it all turns on affection. So the key character is Margaret, and she marries a very, quote, realistic businessman. And ultimately, the difference is between a certain version of business reality over against affection. And affection means, even in the form of grief, right, of having lost, let's say, your favorite place, like one of you mentioned, you know, well, the, you know, the place that I have bonded to, well, it's no longer really there, it's just been developed away, right? But grief is still keeping that affection open, right, that we actually care for, you know, not just the little grandchildren, you know, but we care for land, we care for our community, you know, we care for individual people, and ultimately that's the strongest motivating power. Now, to speak of hope, I often hear, you know, we do a lot of courses in Camrose, and it's, you know, always a mixture between credit students and community members who come to the classes, so we've created an interesting little model. But then, again, some of the very mature people would point to people like Carmel, oh, you are our hope. You young folks, you are our hope. I said that's the most hopeless statement I've heard. Because you're just basically passing the buck. You know, and some will say, well, we screwed it up. You know, but we've got all these lovely young people. But as Chris Hedges says, unless you act, and unless you're disturbed by what's going on, you don't have hope. Hope isn't, let's dump it onto the next generation, the next generation, that's onto the next generation, and then nothing happens. Right? So hope is always actually active, although if you look at a tiger, and this is comes from Aries from the Revolution of Hope, you know, a tiger crouches and seems to be motionless for a long time, but it's ready to pounce. Right? And that's active hope. You have to find the moment, seize the moment where it is appropriate to act. So just a lot of busyness isn't a sign of hope either, right? You can run hither and yon. No, actually go and reflect, go sit back. Get in touch with yourself, uncover your own greed, uncover how much you know you get stimulated by these reinforcements, which don't just come from smartphones. There's thousands of ways that we get reinforced in our covetousness or our greed or our lack of simplicity or whatever, right? So stepping back and not doing something could be a very positive, hopeful sign. But how do we generate that hope? And I think just very, very simplistic, but. If we're taking caring for all creation, in the Christian tradition, actually, and Jewish tradition, we have a lot of the same documents, after all, creation means both nature and community. It's never just nature. It could be you conceive of nature as just a thing in itself, as if it's out there. No, it's nature and community. And ultimately, it means, therefore, that nature heal you, and that genuine human community heal you. But in other words, like in practical terms, Pat and I were in the Black Forest a couple of years ago, and they exist now in Canada too, but we saw a forest school. The kids spend, whether it's grade 1, 2, 3, whatever, they spend over 90% of the time outdoors. Even in bad weather, so you learn how to build a little shelter. But the whole idea is, let nature heal you, then you can participate in the healing of nature, or in the healing of creation. And the same thing with community. You know, if our problem is hyper-individualism, then we have to reconnect ourselves to a concrete place and its real community of people, right? And as that starts healing us, liberating us from our individualism or hyper-individualism, right, then we can participate in the healing of creation at that level. So rebuilding community is crucial to rebuilding a healthy land ethic. Alden Leopold has that phrase, a land ethic can only be, it cannot be constructed on paper. It only can be constructed in the minds of a living community. In other words, by land ethic, he means the land has to have a voice. I mean, through Elizabeth May, it gets a bit of a voice, but by and large, in political discourse, the land isn't in Bolivia? Bolivia, Mother Earth is a charter member. Like, you know, if you want to look at the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, right, the rights of Mother Nature is written right into their constitution. We don't have that. You know, we can go to our individual freedoms, but that ultimately it all hinges on how much we care for, that means how much we love, you know, this planet. So how Helen Caldicott used to say it when she, you know, wrote about the nuclear threats to people. But ultimately, that's the driving force. If you have genuine affection, as you do for your children, your grandchildren, or whatever, in your community, then you will also have that positive energy of reconnecting, right? And so it's an internal reconnecting, you know, how do we connect to ourselves? And so it's never out there. It's both, you know, if you want a spiritual journey, reflect on yourself, and it's a journey outward, reconnect. You know, what's your piece of land? What's your community? You know, whether you're building community on people or between people and the land on which they're living. And I think that's the major driving force that we're trying to work through these, whatever, 10 or 12 weeks or whatever. And I think we're close to the time where we should show what they do in the next couple of weeks. So just very briefly then, for hope is not passivity, saying the next generation will do it. Hope is not also defensive apathy, and defensive apathy is the issues are so large, which they are, and if you calculate your chances of success, you say, what can I do? You know, it's just the 20 of us, or it's just the 30 of us, or whatever. Or, you know, and of course we know there's lots of other people who are concerned about these issues, but it's a small bunch. And so it's very easy to then sort of give up. Wendell Berry, when he was interviewed recently, simply said, you know, they always ask him, well, you know, are we still in time? He says, we can't even ask that question. If we love our children and our grandchildren and this earth, we have to work towards doing what is right and what is healing. And we cannot do it by calculation of success. Right. I mean, that's a very important part. So hope is not a question of can we do it, right? Nor is hope false optimism. False optimism is the notion, you know, like the tar sands are a mess, I mean, you know, or, you know, the tailing lakes, you know, at, which according to industry calculations could leak up to 6 million liters a day per tailing lake. And of course, the new Environment Canada study shows, well, actually, in India, there has been significant leakage. They don't quite know the quantities. So the false optimism is, well, we'll get a technological solution in time, right? We create all these problems, and then the thing, technology that creates the problems, we will rely on to somehow magically create the solution. And, you know, I'm sure you're bored with this example, but one of us up in Yellowknife, a beautiful example is the giant mine there. It's the gold mine, right? They have something like 360,000 tons of arsenic trioxide there, which is so toxic that they can't move it. And, of course, the company no longer exists. It now belongs to us Canadians, right? It brought us to the taxpayers to deal with that as a problem, which is often the case, right? The industry has done whatever it could do. Then you leave it behind, you then go broke, right? And they're no longer in business. Anyhow, so, well, the current solution is you have to permanently freeze it in place. You can't move it, it's too toxic. Well, since our technology is so good that forever and ever, for the ages upon ages, you know, our refrigeration systems will work. None of our fridges have ever broken down. So we're now going to freeze the arsenic trioxide in place forever. You know, and it's similar, like, that's magical thinking. Like if people say, you know, religious folks are superstitious or magical, well, this is really magical thinking, right? I mean, it's not a leap of faith, it's a leap of foolishness. If you think that all of a sudden these gigantic things that we are creating that are, you know, as environmental problems, we will not all of a sudden just fix it. Today, the Saskatchewan Premier announced that, well, he had to go to Washington to talk about the joys of carbon capture, which is, again, whitewashing. Okay, we have a technological solution. Of course, we're not capturing the carbon that's coming out of our PFAS or anything. You know, it's just in a particular industry site. Only one company, I think, in Alberta has accepted it. Everybody else has said, actually not. And of course, the Saskatchewan itself, it hasn't worked. The stuff started bubbling up out of the earth and destroyed all sorts of other stuff. So, but anyhow, so but that's technological optimism, okay? So we'll somehow solve it. And that's not hope, right? Hope has an awful lot to do with seizing the moment because we have a will for the future, because we love life and we love community and we love the next generation.